Journalist Moya Sarner starts an article in The Guardian this way. One night, about 5 years ago, just before bed, I saw a tweet from a friend announcing how delighted he was to have been shortlisted for a journalism award. I felt my stomach lurch and my head spin, my teeth clench and my chest tighten. I did not sleep until the morning. Another 5 years or so before that, when I was at university, I was scrolling through the Facebook photos of someone on my course, whom I vaguely knew. As I clicked on the pictures of her out clubbing with friends, drunkenly laughing, I felt my mood sink so fast I had to sit back in my chair. I seemed to stop breathing. I have thought about why these memories still haunt me from time to time, why they have not been forgotten along with most other day-to-day interactions I have had on social media. And I think it is because in my 32 years, those are the most powerful and painful moments of envy I have experienced. I had not even entered that journalism competition, and I had never once been clubbing and enjoyed it. But as I read that tweet, and as I scrolled through those photographs, I so desperately wanted what those people had that it left me as winded as if I had been punched in the stomach. We live in the age of envy, Sarner writes. Not that our age invented it, obviously. 1,000 years before Pope Gregory I standardized the list of the 7 deadly sins, Aristotle defined envy as pain at the sight of another's good fortune, stirred by those who have what we ought to have. What Sarner and others have identified as a unique challenge in our age of envy is the wide use of social media. In the same article, clinical psychologist Rachel Andrew says she is seeing more and more envy in her consulting room from people who can't achieve the lifestyle they want, but which they see others have. She explains, "I think what social media has done is make everyone accessible for comparison. In the past, people might have just envied their neighbors, but now we can compare ourselves with everyone across the world." You may have been listening to CBC this Wednesday morning when David Common on The Current spoke to two young people about the struggles they have had interacting on social media. They are responding to a study that was recently released from the University of Montreal in which higher levels of depression symptoms like sadness, hopelessness, and even suicidal thoughts were found to be present the more teen participants used social media. Asiya Barakzai, a 22-year-old studying political science at Western, described how she felt before deleting her social media accounts for 2 years. She felt a constant fear of judgment, this constant checking, the highly unrealistic beauty standards, and these over-the-top, extravagant lifestyles that were put out by beauty gurus and influencers. And then just this constant comparison that we draw within ourselves, like, oh, I'm struggling with X, Y, and Z, and everyone else's lives seem so perfect. So after that, I realized it was like, now it's time for me to take a break. And especially rethink all of these toxic behaviors and just readjust myself. That's a good goal for all of the Snakes and Ladders series too, to rethink all of these toxic behaviors and just readjust ourselves. Jeff Cook, in his book 7, The Deadly Sins and the Beatitudes, defines envy as the rejection of the good life God has given me for an obsession with what God gives to someone else. He says that envy's 3 favorite words are, "Why not me?" Last Sunday, I identified a difference between unhealthy and healthy pride. The difference between the hubris that separates us from others and the groundedness in belovedness that gathers people together. On a similar theme of separation, Cook writes that exile is the natural state of envy, because envy separates us from who we were made to be and the life we were made to enjoy. Envy is the sin that insists we transform into something we are not, and when I am separated from myself, I become truly lost. Once again, though, I think things aren't strictly straightforward in identifying the sinner and the sinned against. We heard the confession of the psalmist earlier that I was envious of the arrogant, I saw the prosperity of the wicked. They scoff and speak with malice. Loftily they threaten oppression. Therefore the people turn and praise them and find no fault in them. That, incidentally, feels rather evocative of this week's news when a U.S. president can make directed racist comments and still the people turn and praise them and find no fault in them. The psalmist, we could say, is guilty of the sin of envy. And what is the psalmist doing being envious of such horrible people? Does the psalmist also wish to wear pride as a necklace and violence as a garment? The psalmist has got to rethink and readjust. But the objects of the psalmist's envy are also guilty, wicked, violent, oppressive. And when I think of those young people who are speaking about the pressure they feel and comparisons they make on social media, I also want to shine a light on the industries that make plenty of money by stirring up this envy and low self-esteem in people of all ages. The other story I considered for children's time was Dr. Seuss's The Sneetches. If you haven't read that bedtime story recently, I'll remind you of it. It begins with a population of Sneetches, identical except that some have stars on their bellies and some do not. The story is quite focused on how these groups of Sneetches treat and feel about each other in their differences, in turn envious and arrogant. But there's also this character, Sylvester McMonkey McBean, who arrives with an amazing machine that gives or removes stars on bellies, depending on the fashion of the moment, and with, of course, an increasing monetary fee. As the Sneetches go back and forth, stars on and off, wanting to be like the other group who they perceive as better, Dr. Seuss says, "Of course, from then on, as you probably guessed, things really got into a horrible mess. All the rest of that day on those wild, screaming beaches, the fix-it-up chappie kept fixing up Sneetches. Off again, on again, in again, out again, through the machine, they raced round and about again, changing their stars every minute or two. They kept paying money, they kept running through. Until neither the plane nor the star bellies knew whether this one was that one was this one, or which one was what one, or what one was who. Then when every last cent of their money was spent, the fix-it-up chappie packed up, and he went. And he laughed as he drove in his car up the beach. They never will learn. Nope, you can't teach a Sneetch." The Sneetches do, in fact, learn that Sneetches are Sneetches, stars or not. But Sylvester still just gets to drive off into the sunset to make money off the next unsuspecting, envious town. So are the Sneetches the sinners or the sinned against? Or do the systems at play in our world sometimes get us caught in a cycle of both? Now, just to complicate things further, like we reflected on healthy pride last Sunday, I want to name what could be a healthy engagement with envy. Cognitive behavioral therapist Wendy Dryden differentiates between unhealthy envy and its healthy form, which she says can be creative. Just as hunger tells us we need to eat, the feeling of envy, if we can listen to it in the right way, could show us what is missing from our lives that really matters to us. The clinical psychologist I named earlier says it is about naming it as an emotion, knowing how it feels, and then not interpreting it as a positive or a negative, but trying to understand what it is telling you that you want. If that is achievable, you could take proper steps towards achieving it. But at the same time, ask yourself, what would be good enough? Something akin to envy could be the necessary creative force in broader quests for justice, too. I thought of this graphic as I thought of the idea of healthy envy. We have these definitions of equality, where everyone has the same thing, right? But that's not what everyone needs. And then equity, everyone gets the supports they need. And then we also have justice on the other side, where no supports are needed because the cause of the inequity was addressed. The systemic issue was fixed. Changing the fence is the kind of creativity that can happen when one person says, "I need what that person has, and this is why it is important to my flourishing." So now that I've complicated envy for us, where does that leave us with our vices and virtues? The gospel story we heard is another one of Jesus' classic reversals. Last Sunday, it was all who exalt themselves will be humbled, and all who humble themselves will be exalted. Today, we heard the last will be first, and the first will be last. I usually think of that statement as Jesus turning the power structures upside down as he announces the reign of God. But this week, in light of our theme, I thought about when you are looking at someone enviously, it's you who are putting yourself in last place and them in first. The sin of envy makes a competition out of things that aren't. The landowner in the parable says, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for the usual daily wage? Are you envious because I am generous?" So the last will be first, and the first will be last. About 10 years ago, I wrote a sermon about King Saul's envy of young David, and I named that envy can blind us, break our relationships, and block our potential. And I think this rings true in today's parable too. The envious laborers are blinded to the good they have been given, everything that was promised to them, and everything they need. Rather than seeing what their neighbor has as what their neighbor needs to survive on, they see their payment as not enough. Their relationships with their fellow workers and their employer are broken. The first workers are resentful from everyone around them, and how do those other workers then interact with them? And though the landowner says, "Friend," that is said with derision, sort of a "listen, buddy." And in terms of blocked potential, the first workers, you'll notice, are dismissed from the vineyard after one day of work. They're excluded now from its economy. They are stuck staring at what someone else has rather than seeing what they do have and can't move forward. So in response to being blinded, broken, and blocked, I offer some more alliteration as our practices in response to envy: to be grounded, grateful, and growing. Being grounded was last week's sermon, so just a quick recap is that our formational stories show humanity being created from the very ground, reflecting the image of God. We are created and beloved children of God in all of our uniqueness. Let's not blind ourselves to this truth. Let's not blind ourselves to that truth about others. And all of us with unveiled faces, seeing the glory of the Lord as though reflected in a mirror, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, the Spirit, 2 Corinthians. Just as each of us looks into a mirror and sees a different image, the reflection of God's Spirit will take shape in different gifts and different opportunities for each person. When we are blinded by desiring what someone else has, we need to reclaim our own sense of worth. We need to reclaim our identity as a beloved child of God, who has been called to follow Christ with whatever gifts we have been given. And be grateful. Little Spoon in the children's story could have let his envy break his relationships with his friends. How do you interact with someone who's always saying, "Oh, I wish I had what you had. I wish I had what you had." But his mother helped him to practice gratitude for all that he had. The psalmist, after confessing envy, arrives at gratitude to God. "Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. And afterward, you will receive me with honor. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire other than you. God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. For me, it is good to be near God. I have made the Lord God my refuge to tell of all your works." The psalmist has found what is enough. And finally, growing. I said that healthy envy can be a creative force. The twinges of envy within us could have a root in something very positive, our own hopes and dreams of where we would like to be, our own imaginings of how we might use the gifts God has given us. So rather than being stuck and blocked by what we wish we had, why not recognize what we are yearning for and seek out God's guidance? Is this desire truly in line with what God wishes for us? What might this yearning be preparing us for? How can it move us forward in our quest to follow after Christ? In Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, he addressed a conflict in the young congregation. Jealousy and quarreling among them related to who had which teacher and which was better. Paul reminds them that he and Apollos were only servants who had tended the garden of their faith, but God had caused them to grow. Stop being stuck in those arguments, Paul is saying, and recognize that you all want to grow up into Christ. Grounded, grateful, and growing. In a word, be present here, not wishing for there or that or what they have, not exiling yourself from who you were made to be. Be present in your own life, grounded in your belovedness, grateful for what is before you, and growing in what is within you. Will you sing a prayer with me to close? You are all we have. You give us what we need. Our lives are in your hands, O Lord. Our lives are in your hands. You give us what